the Allstate Skyline Studio.
WGN Radio presents A Conversation.
I want to make one thing perfectly clear.
A dialogue.
What are you prepared to do?
An astute debate.
Everything within the law.
And a peek behind the curtain of politics.
And then what are you prepared to do?
I think Chicago is not only the center of the country, I think it's the center of the world.
Don't tread on them.
Where did this statement come from?
This is the Sunday Spin. Your host is the Chicago Tribune's Rick Pearson.
Good Sunday morning, everyone. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune, and welcome to this edition of the Sunday Spin for March the 17th, 2019. Happy St. Patrick's Day, everybody. Welcome to our weekly look at the world of politics and policy, going from City Hall to the State House and on to the White House. So time to grab that Sunday paper, get that hot cup of coffee, and we'll do our best to get your week off to a great start. Well, St. Patrick's Day it is, the wearing of the green.
And a top of the morning to you, Rick O. Pearson.
I don't think I've ever heard O. Pearson before.
O. Pearson.
Yes. Well, yeah, I know. They
well,
say everybody's
about as appropriate as O'Schwan.
Yes, yes. Well, although there have been times in the newsroom where I've taken a look at you and went, O'Schwan. Yeah. I mean, come on.
That's true. That's
yes.
true.
Yes.
Yes, that's O-H, not no O apostrophe. And there have been other words that we probably can't say.
And it started with an O.
We welcome Joe O'Brand in the
yes.
sports studio.
It's actually, it's Mick Brand.
Mick Brand.
Mick Brand. Okay. Great. Well, just
you
so we get all of this down.
You?
Well, so did you guys go out and do anything yesterday with the big parade and all of that?
No.
Yeah, I was traveling.
Joe was out.
I wish. I was traveling. Yeah, I'm already feeling too old for this kind of stuff.
Please.
I wish I could have been here. I actually, this would have been the perfect view to see them dye the river.
Absolutely.
I saw the pictures. I was very, very jealous.
No, and I mean, you can still see some of it as the sun comes up over Lake Michigan, and it's retained some of its green dye.
Oh, I thought it had all fizzled out. That's just how the river looks.
No. I mean, look westbound.
Yeah, okay, you're right. It's a little more Kelly green that way.
Yes. But again, we don't have the full, you know, sunlight view here, so that can sharpen things up. But I stayed completely away from downtown yesterday. I just thought that was the wise thing to do.
Walking in today, you saw the remnants of broken Jameson bottles and...
Well, you know, it's different now that we're located on this side of the river rather than across the river in Tribune Tower, because then I would normally be venturing through Lower Hubbard and Illinois and Kinzie, and that's where you would actually find some of the people still, you know, left over that apparently couldn't find the train back to the suburbs.
Shaking some dust off from the night before.
Yeah, kind of stepping over some people and that kind of thing. And so it's a little different this time coming in on this side of the river. But we've got the big South Side parade going on. It kicks off at noon today, I believe. So, I mean, this is like a never-ending holiday in Chicago, I think. But
well, it certainly starts earlier than most.
Yes.
And goes until midnight tonight. 12:01 tomorrow morning.
Well, I did set the crock pot to low with the corned beef in it, and so that should smell pretty good when I get
that. Will be wonderful.
The potatoes and the carrots, onions, and then
cabbage.
The cabbage goes in later because you don't want to have that cook too long.
It'll get all wilted,
right? So, although it is cabbage, so what's there's flavor there, but so I'm looking forward to that part of it, and hopefully it won't shrink too much that there might actually be enough left over for a sandwich later. That would be nice.
Do you prefer Swiss cheese on a sandwich with corned beef, or some mustard, or horseradish, or all of the above?
Swiss cheese, horseradish, mustard, and sauerkraut.
Oh, so, okay. Well, that's a Reuben sandwich.
No, not well. Yeah, I mean,
almost.
I mean, it's not the Thousand Island.
No,
that. And but yeah, I like a good Reuben. In fact, I I wish I had thought of this or known this before I bought the corned beef was Mariano's had Reuben sausages.
Wow.
Ground corned beef with sauerkraut mixed in them.
Wow. That sounds...
That would be tasty.
Yeah, that sounds amazing.
Good?
I've had Reuben egg rolls before.
Yeah, those are good.
Those are awesome, yes.
Those are good.
That I've never had before.
Yeah.
Oh, it's very
those
good.
Those are good. Don't have any blood work done after.
But, yeah, stay away from the scale a few weeks after that.
But they are quite good.
Wow, yes. That does sound good. That does sound good. Well, as soon as we get past, I mean, obviously I've got the corned beef today, but as soon as we get past the mayoral election, some of us on the Tribune team kind of do a debriefing over at Manny's. So,
there you go.
Speaking of don't get on the scales afterwards. But, I love it.
That's Politics Central over there. That's the right place to have the debriefing.
Exactly. So that way we can discuss, you know, how to make things better the next time. Which... We hope there's a next time. That's the first thing.
Yes.
And in fact, we'll have a guest today. Maybe we'll talk about, maybe we won't have 14 candidates running for mayor next time. We'll talk about plans, proposals for ranked choice voting, which is done in some other states and cities. And be kind of an interesting concept, given what we saw in kind of the great clutter of candidates that we had, now down to two for the runoff on April 2nd. Joe, I wanted to ask you, I don't know if you saw the news because you were traveling, but this whole deal with the Bradley Braves basketball team, and they're the Missouri Valley Conference basketball men's champions, and they decided that they didn't like the beat writer Dave Reynolds, who's been covering Bradley, by the way, for 29 years.
Right.
This is not like somebody, you know. They didn't like the way he covered the team because he didn't promote the brand.
Yeah. Just that statement in general. I don't understand how a school, let alone any type of sports organization, to get away with saying something like that. Say again?
D1.
Yeah, exactly. And we were talking before the show just how great the story was for Loyola last year and how great it was for the state of Illinois and the city of Chicago that this new team was going on quite a run. And who knows, maybe we could have had Bradley be that this year. But no matter what they do in the tournament now, it's going to be overshadowed by this story and just their... The way that the Peoria Journal star labeled it is pettiness. I mean, how do you get away with saying that the reporter, and a lot of times at these games, Rick, he's the only guy there.
Right. Only media there.
How do you get away criticizing him when he's just doing his job?
Well, I mean, it's the nature of the business that people are going to be writing things that a coach doesn't like or a politician doesn't like. But that's the game. That is the business. And to be this thin-skinned and petty that at a pre-NCAA kind of briefing, because Bradley's going and they get an automatic berth from being conference champ.
Correct.
At a pre-briefing, the beat reporter is told, oh, you weren't invited here. And no, you don't get access to the players.
Yeah, limited credentials. And the other thing is, you know, when the story came out, obviously, when these things happen, it's easy to jump on the favorable side. And following Twitter, everybody supporting Dave Reynolds. I briefly know him when I was at Illinois State covering basketball there. I would see him when ISU would play Bradley. But I've heard from so many other people about his work. And no, I haven't been following his work on Bradley basketball all year. But the fact that the Braves made that tweet yesterday, basically backtracking everything that they did, just shows that they realize now that they're in the wrong. So it doesn't even matter if you weren't following along the whole time, because now they're trying to cover their tracks.
But it never should have gotten there in the first place.
Correct.
And the other thing is, and this is kind of what I find astonishing, is so, yeah, you mentioned about Loyola, the promotion that this brings on a national level, even though you're, you know, one of the first rounders, still, you're the only Illinois team
right.
in the NCAA. Two, you know, Bradley is it's a historic institution in this state, you know,
right.
and certainly they've got their basketball team hasn't been great for a while, they have a great basketball legacy that exists for basketball fans.
And a lot more alumni coming from there than I realized. I knew of the Andy Mazers and the Pete McMurrays of the world, but, I mean, a lot of people have been coming out of the...
Charlie Steiner.
Yeah, correct.
I mean, that I didn't know that until I saw Charlie's tweet.
I knew he was from Peoria. I didn't realize he was a Bradley guy, too.
But the thing is, so you do this right before the tournament when... Bradley has no control over media when the tournament begins.
That's one of the funniest things about this whole thing is this was honestly one of the one scenarios where Bradley had control because it was gearing
up. The last scenario they had control
right.
before. Then it's the NCAA's game. Everybody's got free access, equal access, all that kind of thing. This was their one and only chance to try and stonewall this reporter.
Well, and it sounds like they would have tried to do that before as well, because the Missouri Valley Conference Tournament is the same way. You have to go through that organization in order to get the surpass
through
the
conference.
Yes, yes.
It's a conference event. It's
correct.
Not a team event.
Right.
It's a school event, as it were. I don't know. I just read it, and I just was horribly frustrated and disappointed, because I know a lot of people that went to Bradley. They're not dumb people. When did the dumb people start to take over the school? That's what I don't understand. There ought to be some changes made there, and I hope some of the alumni are listening to what's been going on over there. Great win for the Blackhawks last night, 2-0.
Yeah, how about
it? I only made it through the first period, I admit.
They started earlier, too.
Yeah, well, yeah, 6 o'clock
you know,
game. But
an early 6 o'clock.
Yeah, I know, but I want to be prepared for today's show. But 48 saves by the Crow, and it was Carey Price, who's the Montreal goalie, and I was watching the Channel 9 coverage, and it was kind of weird because, you know, they came back from a break and they went right to center ice, and there's Carey Price and his family at center ice, and they're presenting him with this golden goalie stick with 315 written on it. And then there's this, you know, big guy next to him in a suit or whatever. And I don't know that the communications was all that great with Pat Foley and that, because they didn't really explain that until they came back, that Carey Price believed that 315 is the record for victories for a Montreal Canadian goaltender.
Wow. I didn't see that part. So did you say that was before the game? Or
yeah, it was right at the pregame. That 315, because with that storied history of the Montreal Canadiens,
right,
is you know, and then you had you know, one of their great former goalies presenting the stick to him.
Well,
and I mean, that's a kind of a great history moment. Jacques Plante presenting him with the 315 stick, but no one explained that was Jacques Plante.
Well, and you mentioned Crawford, first Blackhawks goalie with 48 saves since Dave Dryden.
Yes.
1969. And that's a quality win for that team, because even when they were on that winning stretch, a lot of those games it was the offense bailing out the team. But with Crawford coming back again and just showing signs of this again, just shows what type of goaltender he really is when he's at his peak. And he could be maybe the deciding factor if, with these final 11 games left, if the Hawks are really going to make a push for this playoff run or not.
Well, he's definitely playing big, and he can see everything that's going on. And
yeah. One of the, I think it was Jonathan Toews, was saying in that last minute, he just kept getting totally scattered with goals. And it wasn't that these were lucky saves and he was flailing around. He was just reading the puck the entire time.
Right. I mean, he was on it. He was on it, which, well, you know, it's still, to me, a long shot to get there. But five back from Arizona, 3 points back from Minnesota, which is just outside the wild card.
Colorado's a point behind. They play today at 2.
And next week, I'm not sure, is really great because I think we've got Minnesota and Arizona playing each other. And Arizona and Dallas playing each other. And Dallas is flopping with St. Louis from the conference to the wild card slot. So it's going to be tough. But anyway, it's still fun to watch. And it gives some hope. If they don't make it to the playoffs this year, it gives some hope for next year. And hopefully tighten up that defense just a little bit.
Absolutely.
Well, Dave's here to keep us up to date on all the news. Joe Grant. Oshwani. What?
Oshwani.
Oshwani?
Yeah.
Just for today. Okay. You're getting it then. Oshwani's here to keep us up to date on all the news. Joe Brandt has the latest sports. Producer Casera's in and fielding your calls at 312-981-7200. You can also text us at 312-981-7200. We're on Facebook at facebook.com/thesundayspin. We're on Twitter at @SundaySpin. Engineer Bob is roasting the corned beef over in Studio D. You can find all of our shows on WGNRadio.com. You can also find our podcast at iTunes by searching for my name, Rick Pearson. You're listening to The Sunday Spin on WGN. Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson from the Chicago Tribune here in the Allstate Skyline studio overlooking a Kelly Green Chicago River from 18 floors up. Dave, where is the snow? It looks to me like it's kind of staying south of the city.
Yes, south-southwest. And I have to say, this was a bit of a surprise because it was rather mild here, you know, in the city and in the immediate area around the city. But there has been some snow issues southwest of the city. Once again, this would be at I-80 eastbound between Manuka Road and I-57. So this is well southwest of Chicago. I-80 westbound between 80th Avenue and Manuka Road. They had just enough snow there where it has slowed traffic on the expressway area there. And also, we've had a number of accidents. An overturned vehicle now that we just had come up a few minutes ago on 394 south at US 30. That's near Sauk Village. And then an accident blocking the three left lanes eastbound on 8094 right at the Illinois-Indiana line. So despite the fact that things are a bit milder, comparatively speaking, the weather can be a problem in some areas here.
Yeah, I did not foresee that happening at all. I mean, obviously we're paying attention to the big flooding that's going on in Nebraska and Iowa and in Wisconsin. They're already talking about fears of flooding going on in Baton Rouge when all of the water moves south on the Mississippi. But people sending in texts that it's snowing like crazy in Tinley Park and not a simple dusting.
Yeah.
It's very unique how it's the dividing line has been created.
Localized here, so areas, but could cause some problems on the roadways. And Rick, you mentioned flooding. We've been indicating today that there are flood warnings. These flood warnings are in effect until further notice for Winnebago, Kane, Kendall, Lee, and Ogle counties due to the flooding that we've seen up there. And we also have a flood warning until 1 o'clock Wednesday morning for Bureau, LaSalle, and Putnam counties. We are getting into the early spring thaw, and the horrible flooding that we've seen in western Iowa and eastern Nebraska. So you would only think that anticipate things that would be moving further north through Grand Forks and that area that had some horrible flooding a number of years ago up there.
Yeah, and it's just not pleasant. It's not pleasant at all, and all that water's going to move, and it's going to move south, and that's going to create all kinds of headaches and
things. Let's just hope we don't have a repeat of 1993.
I don't even want to think about that.
I even brought it up.
Yeah, that was amazing.
That was horrific.
Somebody just texting me now, Mantino getting at least
3 inches
of snow now.
Yeah. This is not, that's not lake effect necessarily.
No, not at all. So please, everybody, be safe. Be on the lookout, okay, for the precipitation. And if it's snow, it's not going to be pleasant. So just everybody, please take it easy. Time for our weekly spin through national politics and all kinds of announcements. You've heard it during Dave's newscast. Kirsten Gillibrand, the senator from New York, announcing in a video this morning that she has joined the ever-growing list of contenders for the Democratic nomination for president in 2020. This comes after Beto O'Rourke, the former congressman from Texas, got into the race after a very flattering Vanity Fair cover story that also included a story by a Reuters reporter talking about how O'Rourke in his teen years had been part of a very major kind of group of hackers. An interesting controversy over that, because the story written by a Reuters reporter who had learned of that basically in 2007, but agreed to keep it confidential until after O'Rourke's U.S. Senate race. He lost to Ted Cruz. That was an agreement that was struck. The reporter said, well, he couldn't prove the deal about hacking until after the Senate race was over, and that's what he says. All these kinds of things coming on, you know, questions about O'Rourke, you know, other than the fact that he did serve in Congress, does he have enough experience to actually be somebody to run for president of the United States? Not holding office now hasn't stopped him from going to Iowa, and of course New Hampshire coming up soon. And then in Delaware, you had Joe Biden, who gave a speech talking, basically the idea was to talk about how it ought to be the Delaware principle that guides politics, talking about a more gentle, more civil attitude in politics. But he went on to basically say, and I'm paraphrasing here, that when you look at the candidates running for president, you know, he has the most experience. And then quickly backtrack to say, no, I'm not making that announcement. No. But certainly, even Democratic Party officials in Delaware say they're convinced that the former vice president has made up his mind and certainly intends to be a candidate for president of the United States on the Democratic side. All of that, of course, leading up to the big Democratic National Convention for 2020 to be held just up the road in Milwaukee, which is going to be its own kind of interesting scenario. Don't get me wrong, Milwaukee's a great town. I always have fun when I'm there. I'm just not sure that it can house all of these people who are going to be coming in. I'm not sure it can house the number of candidates for president that the Democrats have, let alone all of these delegates from across the country. I mean, it's conceivable that there may be some people staying downtown here in Chicago that will have to be bused up to Milwaukee every day for the convention. So that'll be a very interesting thing. Certainly be good news for probably the hotels in Lake County. I mean, there will be some spinoff for Chicago and that kind of thing. But again, it's such a big production to put on a major convention. When Charlotte, North Carolina, hosted the Democratic convention last time, I stayed, as did several delegates. We stayed in South Carolina across the border. That's just how massive a production this kind of thing is. So it'll be interesting to see how Milwaukee's prepared to handle all that. Of course, that's down the road, and by then, we'll assume there might be a Democratic nominee for president at that point. But something to keep your eye out as more and more people keep jumping into the race. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune. Time for our weekly spin through national politics, and we start with the effort approved by the House to make special counsel Robert Mueller's report public when it's released. Now, in the Senate, Democratic leader Chuck Schumer urged the Senate Republicans not to block it.
Something rather amazing and wonderful happened in the House of Representatives. The House of Representatives this morning passed a resolution expressing the sense of Congress that the full report by Special Counsel Robert Mueller should be made available to the public and to Congress. The vote was 420 to nothing. That is 420 to nothing. Not a single member of the House, Democrat or Republican, voted no.
That's the Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer on that 420 to nothing House vote. So, he says Senate Republicans, don't block it. Guess what? It was blocked by Republicans in the Senate. Here's South Carolina Republican Senator Lindsey Graham.
Was there two systems of justice in 2016, one for the Democratic candidate and one for the Republican candidate, where the Republican candidate's campaign had a FISA warrant issued against somebody associated with it based on a document that was known to be unreliable, politically charged on four different occasions? That should bother every American. And rather than me telling you whether it happened or not, why don't we appoint a Mueller-like figure to look at how the Clinton email investigation ended up the way it did?
So there we go, back to the Clinton emails. Now, there were a dozen Senate Republicans who joined with Democrats in passage of a resolution of disapproval of Trump's emergency order to use Pentagon funds to build his border wall. And, of course, the president issued a veto.
It's not going to be overturned, and we're going to have our whole thing. It's been the legal scholars all say it's totally constitutional. It's very important. It's really a border security vote. It's pure and simple. It's a vote for border security. It's a vote for no crime. See, we have a border situation also, but it's slightly different than yours. Ours is not actually complex. We have very, very bad laws that are archaic, that were put in by Democrats, and the Republicans didn't fight hard enough at the time. That was a long time before me, but we have catch and release, and we have chain migration, and we have all sorts of things that are horrible. And the world is laughing at the laws that were passed with respect to us.
Now, Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell of Kentucky urged his Republican colleagues to hold tight and support the president.
He has simply operated within existing law, the National Emergencies Act of 1976, to invoke a narrow set of authorities to reprogram a narrow set of funds. If Congress has grown uneasy with this new law, as many have, then we should amend it. If the 116th Congress regrets the degree of flexibility that the 94th Congress gave the executive, the 116th Congress has the ability to do something about it.
Well, now, joining us now here in the Allstate Skyline studio is Tim Egan. He's the CEO of Roseland Community Hospital. And, Tim, thanks so much for joining me this morning.
Good morning.
We've talked a number of times on this show about the problems facing these very, very vital safety net community hospitals. And now we have the problem of these managed care organizations that are basically kind of the intermediary that you all are dependent upon for funding, but then where's the money? They're holding the money. And you're dealing with Medicaid clients.
Right.
That's the reimbursement.
Amen.
So there's legislation in Springfield. What are we trying to do here?
So we got about 10 different bills that are going to put an audit and oversight on the managed care organizations. When the state used to reimburse the hospitals directly, the denial rate was about 3-4%. Right now, the managed care organization denial rate is 26%.
26% of every dollar?
Every dollar.
Now, I mean, the concept of the MCOs was good. It was, I mean, in theory.
In theory, yes. Actually, when they started with the MCO program in Illinois, the safety net hospitals are actually allowed to play in the game. We had these accountable care entities, these ACEs. that we were able to manage our own lives that we cared for on a day-to-day basis. We were able to play in that game. And then a Rauner administration came in and said, you know, you safety net hospitals have to put $30 million into an account to make sure that you can cover all the claims. Come on, we're safety net hospitals. We don't have
$30 million. Where's the $30 million? right.
So now all of managed or all the Medicaid lives are being shifted into these managed care organizations. Now, if you're looking at this globally, I think there was a story just in the news this week that because of Trump's tax laws, that you know, Blue Cross Blue Shield just pocketed another $1.5 billion. You know, it's great that they are managing managed care and Medicaid in Illinois, so some guy in Bethesda, Maryland can get another new boat. But we're down there on the front lines taking care of people who are shot, stabbed, beaten, raped in our emergency room, and we can't get the dollars we need to survive.
So, in essence, this legislation you mentioned about auditing, whatever, but also it's basically to get you the cash.
Amen.
And
can't stress hard enough how the denial rate used to be 3-4% when the state of Illinois managed Medicare or Medicaid, and now it's 26% because the
and plus they sit on it.
Amen. 180 days. And then they deny, and then I have got to go out and hire a third party administrator to go back in and help me with the denials to rebill. You know, one of the most amazing things that ever happened, he said, here's the new structure that you have to bill. You got to do it electronically. And you got to go through all these hoops and jump through it, do this, do that, do that. And then we file everything electronically, and their system, one of the MCO systems went down.
Their system goes down.
Like, now you got to send us the manual bills. Like, oh, come on. Are you kidding me?
Excuses.
Just their job is to get the money from the state and hold on to it as long as they possibly can.
Have there been committee hearings yet on this legislation?
Absolutely. And, you know, I got to commend people like Senator Emil Jones III. I got to commend people like Camille Lilly, state representative, Kimberly Lightfoot. These people are on there, and they're pushing hard, and they're fighting, and they're going to make this stick. These audits have to happen.
Where does this legislation stand? Is it still in committee?
Yeah, it's moving. It's moving forward. I think what will happen is there are so many bills. Fred Crespo's another champ of ours. I think there are so many of these bills that are out there that there's probably going to be consolidated in one huge omnibus MCO bill. And I think that's what's going to pass through the House and the Senate.
But the insurance industry is very powerful.
Oh, they're fighting us. But, you know, no more glorious words have I heard from a governor of the state of Illinois than what JB put in his budget speech, that he's going to put an assessment on those MCOs. And he's going to generate $800 million new dollars for the Medicaid program.
That's part of the budget initiative. Absolutely. That would be matching funds then with the feds and kind of be a boost for all of that underprivileged care that's going on.
Absolutely. It'll generate about $390 million on the assessment, and then the feds match it. So we're rounding up to $800 million. But I can't stress again how wonderful it was to hear JB say that a couple weeks ago, because we've been pushing that bill for 3 years. We did it under the Rauner administration. We said, we don't want to be just here. We're safe at the hospitals with our hand out. We want to come to the table with solutions. And we came to the table with a solution 3 years ago.
Well, and that's been one of the frustrating thing. And it's been frustrating for both sides, because the idea of generating money to get those federal funds has been out there for a while.
Amen. You know, Illinois is one of the state that's at the bottom of the list in terms of generating Medicaid dollars.
In recapture from matching funds from
absolutely.
The feds.
Every other state's way ahead of us. And we need to get in the front line, and we need to generate those dollars, and we need to save hospitals like Roseland Hospital.
Tim Egan, CEO from Roseland Community Hospital, thank you so much for joining me this morning. Sorry it was abbreviated, but I think the message is pretty clear about what needs to happen.
Amen. We need to invest in hospitals like Roseland, not divest. And that's what's happened in the last 10 years in the state of Illinois. They've divested in places like Roseland. The state needs to invest.
Tim, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you, and happy St. Patrick's.
And a happy St. Patrick's Day to you.
Now back to the Tribune's Rick Pearson. It's the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN.
Oh, Lord. Welcome to the second hour of your Sunday Spin on this Sunday, St. Patrick's Day. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune here in the Allstate Skyline studio, 18 stories above the emerald green Chicago River. Well, joining me now on the phone is Rob Ritchie. He's the president and CEO of an organization called FairVote, and the group supports what's known as ranked choice voting. Rob, thank you so much for joining me.
Good morning. Great to be on the program, Rick.
I thought it'd be a good idea to have you on. We've moved past our Chicago mayoral election to focus on the two candidates that are in the runoff on April 2nd. But I kept thinking as we were reporting and covering on 14 candidates running for mayor of City of Chicago to replace Rahm Emanuel, how things might have been different if we instituted what's known as ranked choice voting. So, Rob, I'm going to have you start first by just explaining and dumbing it down in simple terms what ranked choice voting is.
Yeah, well, it is a great way to think about it, and not the only one these days. As we look to the 2020, you know, Democratic presidential nomination contest with an ever-growing field, you know, these
even more,
we have a lot of choices.
Even more today with Kirsten Gillibrand. So,
yeah, it's. I mean, it's just kind of remarkable what is going to unfold there, and it's pretty similar to what the Republicans went through in 2015, 2016, and in our current approach to voting, which we do see a lot of variations of. So people often think, like, well, we just do voting one way in the U.S., and that's not true. There, and ranked choice voting is a good example because it's used in, you know, about 20 cities, the state of Maine, and there's other approaches. But generally, you get a field of candidates, and you can only vote for one of them. You might have views on more than one of them. In fact, we often do. You know, mayoral race like this, people had gotten to know more than one candidate, and they might say, well, you know, I do like this one, but I kind of like this one, and I really don't like this one, or, you know, this kind of, like, gradations of thinking. And ranked choice voting allows you to take those views you already have and put them right on the ballot in a significant way. So what you do, instead of just voting for one person, you get to rank them. So you say, well, here's my first choice, but here's my second choice, and here's my third choice. And then you can, that's why it's called ranked choice voting. You can use rankings in different ways in different systems, but the one that's used around the world and in a growing number of U.S. cities is one that essentially is treating those other rankings as backups. So they're ones to count if your first choice isn't a strong enough candidate to win. And so that's how the name instant runoff is often applied, because it's really trying to kind of simulate what you see in a runoff election. So Chicago's going through a runoff election where you had two candidates who led the field, you know, with a combined vote that was basically only a third of all the vote, but they led the field. Everyone else gets knocked out, and then all those voters who voted for a candidate who's not in the runoff essentially have to look at the candidates and, you know, who are left and pick one if they want to come back and vote. And with ranked choice voting, you've kind of done that already. You said, who's my second choice? Here's my third choice. Here's my fourth choice. And those backups count. So you add up all the first choices. If anyone has a first round majority, you have an instant winner. If not, the candidate in last place is out. The people who voted for that candidate, their ballots go to their next choice and add it to their totals. And you keep doing that until someone gets a majority. So it allows you to do a majority in one round. But it also really changes the psychology of what the candidates are doing, because they are needing to look for connections with the backers of other candidates and sort of learning what makes them tick. And it really kind of changes the engagement philosophy that you see campaigns doing.
Well, is it kind of, I mean, is it demonstrated that, I mean, one of the attractive features of this is that it has the potential of reducing the negativity of campaigns, because you've got candidates that are trying to be, you know, if they can't be the first choice, at least be the second choice.
Exactly. And you have to do it in this kind of affirmative way of looking for connections. And this was a great example because it was such a wide open field, a lot of different candidates, you know, different bases of support, different parts of the city, different racial histories, different, you know, different philosophies. And it's and you as a candidate would be in a position of saying, okay, well, I want to stand out enough to be a lot of people's first choice, but I need to look for connections and find ways to be second and third, fourth choices even, and so on. You know, there were, I think, 9 candidates that got at least 5%, and then, you know, no one who got more than 18%. So it really was this kind of fractured field, and ranked choice voting would have promoted a kind of deeper engagement. It is it is one where that kind of happens in the runoff election. It just happens with only two candidates, and because it's just one-on-one, they have a great temptation to try to get votes by being more comparative and negative than kind of making an affirmative case at this point. And so we'll see how that unfolds, but often one-on-one races get pretty nasty.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, when you looked at the, when you look at the field that we had, and each candidate is going to play to their base, whether it's a racial base, ethnic base, neighborhood base, whatever, because you know that the numbers aren't going to be significant enough that that someone's going to just break out. And so you're playing a game really very small by the margins. And rather than being necessarily forced, I would say, to run kind of a citywide campaign.
You know, 83,000 votes would have made it into the runoff, right? You know, and no one got more than 100,000 votes. So if you could kind of like find that base and make sure they vote for you, that's your goal in the runoff, to get into the runoff. And then you turn around and kind of pivot and then run a runoff campaign. But ranked choice voting kind of would promote sort of doing that all at once. There's pros and cons of kind of having a second bite at the apple, but I think that the cities that are using ranked choice voting, which were some pretty big ones, you know, you're seeing it in Oakland, San Francisco, Minneapolis, St. Paul, it's being adopted in the biggest cities in New Mexico, so some Utah cities are starting to use it, and, you know, statewide in Maine, and it, you know, kind of does have this impact on having the campaigns generally run more civil and more kind of coalition building kind of efforts where they really have to learn about what the other candidates are thinking. Like, so if you're, you know, rhetorically or actually knocking on a door and talking to someone and they find out that, you know, their first choice is some other particular candidate, you kind of need to know what that means. And
sure, what's the affinity exactly. So I know how to address it or to whether to liken that kind of affinity.
Exactly. Yeah.
We're speaking with Rob Ritchie. He's the president and CEO of FairVote, which supports what's known as ranked choice voting. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson from the Chicago Tribune here in the Allstate Skyline studio, joined on the phone by Rob Ritchie, the president and CEO of FairVote. We're talking about the prospects and the use of ranked choice voting in places across the country, if not around the world. Rob, you mentioned that on St. Patrick's Day that Ireland is a country that uses that form of voting.
Yeah, exactly. It has this really fascinating, long-standing history in some other countries. Ireland and Australia both used it about 100 years. Ireland, as soon as it went independent, you know, almost 100 years ago, and Australia since 1918. And we actually came close to that. It's really interesting. That was just in the part of our history when we were changing from having parties nominate by themselves and kind of caucuses and conventions to hold the government coming into organized primaries. And because caucuses and conventions traditionally had a majority process, you know, voting again and again until someone got a majority, there was sort of interest in doing that, but we just didn't have the right kind of equipment in place to make it easy to do. And so some states tried it. It just was administratively difficult. But that's right when Ireland and Australia were doing it, and they just counted ballots by hand and went ahead and went to ranked choice voting. But they've used it a long time. It's completely accepted as the norm. They can regularly have more than two candidates run for office. In Australia, you'll see like kind of an average of seven people contest their House of Representatives elections. But no one talks about spoilers and split votes because they have ranked choice voting. And I think that's something that we're heading to. And, you know, we can look at these international stories to show that it's reassuring that it works.
Well, you mentioned caucuses, and one of the things, and it's not exactly akin, but like with the Iowa caucuses, where there has to be a viability threshold. And so, you know, if a candidate, I think, was normally about 15% in each individual caucus, if they don't have 15% support, then their candidate is not eligible to be counted in that caucus, but that other candidates can solicit support from them to help boost their numbers, and kind of goes to that broader, what's the appeal that, you know, if you don't have enough for this guy, how do I get his guys over to my support kind of thing?
Exactly. Exactly. And so it's interesting, you go back there, you know, going back a little bit in time, back 2004, I know it was a really good example of like a fractured Iowa field. That was when Howard Dean was running and Dick Gebhardt and John Edwards and John Kerry. And Kerry and Edwards really did well in like picking up second and third choices from like Dean voters and Gebhardt voters who had been kind of going negative at each other. And it really had that practical impact. In a very interesting twist is that Iowa is actually going to be using ranked choice voting, it looks like, next year in their caucuses, with, you know, those in-person people doing that same thing, but they're allowing people to vote early with, looks like they're going to do a telecaucus, so people can be right on telephones and do it. Anyway, those people will rank candidates. They'll rank five candidates, and then they'll treat it like a ranked choice vote exactly because of what you're saying, and like that's trying to simulate what the in-person caucus voter does.
What about as far as implementation problems?
Yeah, I mean, that's been the frustration for me. I've done this a long time, and actually when we started in 92, John Anderson, the former Illinois congressman, sure, and independent candidate, was my kind of, you know, cohort in this, had an op-ed in the New York Times way back in 92, and when Ross Perot was running, it sort of made sense for a long time. And we've done other things besides ranked choice voting, but on this one, I just felt it would have zipped along a lot faster if we could have had voting equipment in place where it just became a policy choice rather than having to deal with workaround issues and so on. And the good news for us is sort of the inside baseball, but all the big voting equipment companies have kind of accepted the reality of ranked choice voting. They're putting it in their systems. The standard-making bodies are making standards for it. It's just becoming a norm, and then we can just debate it as policy. And I think, you know, the sky's the limit for it at that point, because there's a lot of conditions in our politics that I think would be benefit improved by ranked choice voting.
Well, and just for folks in Illinois, especially primarily older voters, you know, this isn't that far off from the way we used to elect the Illinois State House members, where it was cumulative voting, and it was you had four candidates running for three spots, and you could cast what was known as the bullet and give the guy just all three of those votes. You could vote for two and go one and a half, one and a half, or you could give each one of them one vote. It's not exactly the same, but it's not unusual to have kind of, you know, seeing those multiple candidates for one office and being able to express some form of support in some way for it.
That's exactly right. And actually, when we brought up Ireland and St. Patrick's Day, it's that kind of system they use for their legislature. So they have multi-member districts, meaning you have more than one person winning, like in the old cumulative voting system. And then they use ranked choice voting, which does sort of mathematically on the representation side what cumulative voting does, but does it in a way that you don't have to bullet vote. Basically, you just have to rank your favorite first and then do backups. And there's a bill in Congress, in fact, the Fair Representation Act in the last Congress, it's soon going to be introduced to essentially put in that IRIS system. And the Illinois model is frequently talked about because what it meant was you had the sort of shared representation across geography. So downstate Illinois, you know, had both Democrats and Republicans representing the same district. Chicago would have both parties representing it because mathematically those voters are there. They are just, you know, lost in a winner-take-all system. Interestingly, an Illinois tidbit is that a student of elections who was a thoughtful member of the state Senate back in 2002 was prime sponsor of a bill to do ranked choice voting for primaries and put cumulative voting back on the ballot and have voters have a chance to bring it back. That was Barack Obama. So, you know, it's interesting. This can attract some pretty thoughtful people. Both John McCain and Barack Obama, when they were running for president in 2008, were interesting to us because they had both been very helpful backers of ranked choice voting.
Well, I think it's a subject certainly worthy to explore, particularly since we've come off after a brutal 2018 election season statewide to move only into a just as brutal 2019 mayoral race. And now we're at least seeing there's light at the end of the tunnel for that on April 2nd. But certainly I think it's something to be explored here in Illinois. Rob Ritchie, president and CEO of FairVote, thank you so much. They can get more information from the website at...
Yeah, at fairvote.org, and I'll shout out to FairVote Illinois, which is a sort of a offspring but an independent group that they can find on Facebook by just putting in FairVote Illinois. But people are really raising this issue in the state, and I think it makes a lot of sense. So glad to be on the program.
Thank you, Rob.
This is the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN. Once again, here's Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune.
Good Sunday morning. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin on this special St. Patrick's Day edition. I'm Rick Pearson, the Chicago Tribune. Just a couple of events I want to let you folks know about, and you're certainly welcome to attend. I do things occasionally for Aurora University, a great institution of higher education out west, and part of their Town Square series. I tend to moderate those things, and it's been a very interesting discussions that we've had on all variety of subjects. And this one, I think, is very interesting. This is about the Rust Belt Revival, the Midwest and the global economy. And I'll be moderating a panel that includes a non-resident senior fellow with the Brookings Institution, John Austin, the mayor of Kokomo, Indiana, Greg Goodnight, Dick Longworth, formerly of the Tribune, distinguished fellow at the Chicago Council on Global Affairs, as well as Julia Taylor, the president of the Greater Milwaukee Committee. And of course, as I mentioned earlier, Milwaukee being in the news, showing its rejuvenation as host of the 2020 Democratic National Convention. So that's out at Aurora University, Creamy Auditorium at 7:30 p.m. And you can go to Arts and Ideas at Aurora EDU for more information about that. That's on Tuesday. And then I will be out at Cantini Park on Thursday for the McCormick House Awareness Series and Civic Awareness Series. And basically something this is put on by the League of Women Voters of Wheaton, as well as the Robert R. McCormick Foundation, kind of an honor of a Tribune reporter getting to be out at Cantini. And we'll be talking about journalism today, about civic education, about civility in education. And that'll be from 7 to 9 p.m. At the Cantini Park Visitors Center. And for more information on that, you can go to cantini.org. Back in the day when I was growing up out in Villa Park, it was Cantigny. But now I took French. Now I know it's cantini.org. And go to their events section, and you can register for that. So be great to see all of you out there in Aurora and out in Wheaton next week. Now, we're going to switch gears, and we have the deputy governor of the state of Illinois, Dan Hines, former state comptroller.
Great to be with you.
Good to be with you. So do I call you governor?
No, please. No, no, no. We have one
governor. I mean, you tried that once.
Yeah, that's
you know.
Right. That's right. We have one governor.
All right.
J.B. Pritzker.
Well, I don't want to call you deputy. Then it sounds like I'm talking to Barney Fife.
Dan is good.
All right, Dan. Fair enough. Fair enough. So, you know, obviously this issue of the graduated rate income tax, I'll let you use the euphemisms, as I call it, graduated rate income tax. Well, now we're finally seeing some more substantive effects of it as far as what it could do with a rate structure. And I think a lot of legislators were surprised that that rate structure came out as quick as it did. And but again, is this the governor's like offering salvo here for negotiating an ultimate rate structure?
It is, yes. The governor has said from the beginning that this would be a discussion and negotiation with the General Assembly, and this was our proposal. We worked very hard at it, and we think we've come to a pretty good balance of raising revenues that are badly needed, but not hurting taxpayers who can ill afford it. And so what we've come up with is that under this plan, 97% of taxpayers would see a reduction or stay the same in their tax burden, and 3% would see an increase. And this is a way to solve a budget crisis. That's what we have to remember. We're not, you know, we're trying to accomplish two things, make the tax system fair and also solve a massive budget deficit.
So we're looking at a budget hole of like $3.2 billion for this next budget year. Not that we would have this graduated rate tax in effect then until 2020, ostensibly. But one of the questions I had is, and you know this from politics too, not that I'm any great advocate of tax increases, but there are so very rare times in a political process that you can go for that bite of the apple. Is this a big enough bite of the apple as far as the revenue that it produces?
It is. I mean, again, we were very careful and deliberative in our process to raise enough money to solve the budget deficit and our structural budget problem, but not asking taxpayers for more than needed. And to your point, I think that the impasse of the last few years and just the, you know, the damage caused by you know, either political turmoil or bad budget management, I think people are aware that there's a problem, and hopefully they realize that there's only a few options. We can cut 15% from our discretionary spending, which would be very, very harmful to people who really need government and those who care about higher education and K through 12. Or we can raise taxes on everybody, which we don't want to do. Or this third plan, which is a fair tax where 3% of taxpayers pay more and 97% pay the same or less.
I was curious about, and let's, I don't want to necessarily go too deep here into the individual rate structure here, but it's, you know, people look at a number and then they look at a rate, and it's like, no, this is, you pay X on the first 10,000, you pay X on the next, and X and X and X up. So it's not, everything is not taxed at that one rate, except for millionaires. And I was kind of curious about how that part figured into the calculation.
Well, I mean, it was just, I mean, simply we looked at the rates to find out what would be fair and what would solve the problem.
A sweet spot. You look for a sweet spot.
We look for a sweet spot. And, you know, the rate structure we've put forward with the highest rate of 7.95% keeps us competitive with our neighboring states, keeps us far below New York, California, and other major states with major metropolitan areas. And that's what we were trying to accomplish. And then within that framework, where can you establish those middle rates where, you know, those under $250,000 would pay less or the same, and between, you know, over $250,000 would see a gradual increase. And so, you know, if you're making $280,000, you're not going to see a huge increase. Going up to $1 million, yes. If you're making $1 million or more, you're going to see a 7.95% effective rate, basically a flat rate. And that rate is, you know, I think a reasonable number for those making over $1 million.
I thought it was interesting the other day where the state Republican Party chairman put out a press release about if a governor wants to pay a fair tax, it ought to start with him, about money offshored, which I thought that was kind of interesting that Tim Snyder would say this, given that Bruce Rauner was the governor who picked him to be chairman, and I don't remember him talking about anything about any kind of fair taxation rate at that point when Bruce Rauner was in charge.
Right. You know, the governor has been very clear that, you know, he thinks our current system is unfair because he's paying the same rate as somebody making minimum wage, somebody making $50,000 a year, a family of four, and that's not right. So the highest rate will go up and he will be paying more. And that's fair and right.
What about as far as the business end of things? And one of the things, I had Greg Bays on, the former head of the Manufacturers Association. He's leading one of the dark money groups. There's pro and con. He's leading the one, Ideas Illinois, that is against it. He, as you call it a fair tax, he calls it a jobs tax, and says that the taxation rate for corporations is going to be significant, as well as the fact of how proprietors that pay their business taxes through the Illinois individual income tax, LLCs, those kinds of things, that they're going to get significantly hit as well.
Well, when you talk about our business climate, I mean, I think you need to step back and look at the big picture, which is that business leaders that I talk to will say that it's a variety of factors that matter to them. They want They want a strong economic base where they're going to locate. They want stability in their government and predictability, and that has been lacking for 4 years with the dysfunction in Springfield and the never-ending bickering and battles going on. We've put an end to that, and they want something, a government that could pay its bills. I think those are important, but to the tax rate, you know, if you look at LLCs, I mean, these statistics include business owners who file with LLCs, and still the facts remain that less than 3% of taxpayers, including those who are receiving income from their businesses, LLCs, are going to be seeing an increase, and 97% will be seeing less. So, you know, many businesses have a flow-through model, the LLC, and so we're really talking about the same model. And in terms of the corporate rate, again, I think the rate right now we're proposing is to tie the corporate rate to the highest personal income, which makes sense because of that whole the reality of the LLC. And I think our corporate rate is competitive, especially when you couple it with those other factors that I mentioned, having a functioning government, having a government that could pay its bills and provide that stability and predictability that they're looking for.
But what about personal property replacement tax, which basically raises that effective business tax rate?
Right. Even when you include that and you take the corporate rate plus the personal property replacement tax, you still are talking about a rate that is competitive with our neighboring states. Because the corporate rate, it has a variety of factors. If you're located in Illinois, you're going to get certain benefits. If you're located outside of Illinois, you lose those benefits of factoring in headcount and assets owned here in the state. So I think when you bring all this together and you really zero in on corporations and businesses that are located here, we're creating, I think, a competitive environment.
We're speaking to Dan Hines, former state comptroller and deputy governor for the state of Illinois, about Governor Pritzker's proposed graduated rate income tax, proposed constitutional amendment. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson, the Chicago Tribune. Here in the Allstate Skyline studio, speaking with Deputy Governor and former State Comptroller Dan Hines, we talk about Governor J.B. Pritzker's proposal for a graduated rate income tax. A couple of text questions have come in. One is there some kind of a marriage penalty that exists with this?
No. We tried to keep this as simple as possible, and so our model just basically assumes the same rates for individual filers and married filers. And so, you know, the question is, well, okay, so are people going to try to do the calculation of whether they're better off filing individually or as couples? You know, the studies have shown that at the state level, you're not going to see a lot of changed behavior, especially since the federal policies and federal tax rates and the benefits of filing jointly far outweigh anything that could happen at the state level. So we don't see that as being an issue. And again, the point we were trying to make and what we were trying to accomplish is to keep it very simple. And so having the one rate and the one structure for both individual and joint filers, we think is simpler, easier, and fair.
Another question, and one that comes up a lot, is where are the budget cuts? And to me, I would think, you know, certainly that's something that Republicans are looking for as they decide whether they want to embark in joining in this discussion on a graduated rate tax. Already we've seen the House Republicans pretty much say no way. Senate Republicans, maybe a little leeway there when they talk about protections for the middle class.
Right. Well, when you talk about cuts, I mean, people need to be specific about where they want to cut, because the budget that the governor presented, I would describe as both austere as well as very targeted to spending where it matters. The increases are in education, human services, public safety. The rest of the budget has been held flat or has had just growth based on inflation, and so It's very difficult to find cuts that aren't going to be very, very harmful to people across the state. And that's really the way we've tried to frame this whole debate, is if you don't like a fair tax, if you believe that a fair tax is not the right solution, then there's only two other options: cutting 15% of discretionary spending, including education, or raising taxes on everybody. And that's where I think we really need to focus this whole debate is, you know, I think people know we have a $3+ billion deficit that can only be solved a few different ways. And if you want to cut, you got to be specific about where you're going to cut 15% of discretionary spending. That's not the option we're looking at.
Well, and I'm not saying you have to cut necessarily all 15%. I think there's a certain kind of buy-in of goodwill that would exist if there was some kind of effort to say, you know, look, we're cutting this. I mean, I'm not talking about the automatic push button that says waste, fraud, and abuse, but certainly we've been around government to know that some things work and some things don't work, and just that, for that accountability factor is what I'm talking about.
Right. I mean, there were cuts contained in the budget. For example, the scholarship program, the private school scholarship program, we curtailed and cut back, and that's something that is you know controversial. I mean, there's people right. who really want that program, and as this process goes on, we can identify others. You have to keep in mind that we had about 6 weeks to put the budget together when we came into office. We went through a very arduous process of working with the agencies. And I would describe the process of putting that budget together as one of saying no to, you know, 90% of spending.
Well, especially
proposals.
Coming off of almost 4 years of starvation.
Yeah, and you know, that's what we heard over and over, is that the agencies had been hollowed out. There's, you know, just severe reductions and kind of freeze of critical human service programs. And that's why we focused our spending increases on education, human services, and public safety while holding line everywhere else.
So that's, we've got this whole issue of the graduated rate kind of hanging over us for the next 2 years. And obviously the legislature will have to decide whether to put it on the ballot. That's something you want that vote. The administration wants that vote this year.
Mm-hmm. Yes, soon.
I think it's probably fair to say that a rate structure also needs to be adopted pending a constitutional amendment, just to try to fill the vacuum that opponents would say, you know, well, it's not going to stop there, it's going to end there. At least it gives a projection out there for people to look at. What about a capital bill? What about infrastructure? Where are we on that?
Yeah, there, you know, we strongly believe there needs to be a capital bill, and we're working hard with the legislature on putting that plan together. It's going to consist of, you know, doing an inventory and calculation of our deferred maintenance needs. There's, you know, it's been nearly 10 years or more since we've had any kind of major capital bill, so our infrastructure is in dire need of investment. So looking at deferred maintenance, looking at our roads, bridges, and infrastructure for our transportation, you know, higher education and K-12, and then, you know, other ideas that the General Assembly comes up with, we welcome. So that's going to be an independent process to the operating budget that we've already proposed, and the fair tax plan that we've proposed is a capital bill, and we think it's very much needed, and we'll be working to get that done.
But then there's always the revenue to pay for it, which that's always the stickler.
Right.
Everybody likes to vote for projects. They don't necessarily want to pay for them.
No, that's right. There needs to be revenue identified to support the bonds that will, as well as any kind of pay-as-you-go portion of the capital bill. And we're starting to work with the legislature on some revenue ideas there.
I mean, it's my view that's something that probably doesn't come together till the scheduled end of the session, and that it's also always good to use for leverage for other things that the administration might want some votes for.
Well, I do think
is that too cynical?
Well, I mean, it all of this needs to be taken into consideration together. Yeah, because you don't want to do things in isolation, and you know, part of solving our budget crisis is to get our economy growing again, and that includes a capital bill that will put people back to work, that will, you know, make our will strengthen our infrastructure, both our roads and bridges as well as just our economic infrastructure. So yeah, we do think it should all be taken together, including the fare tax, which, as you said, you know, we want that voted on this session, and we want a constitutional amendment to be, you know, also include very, very transparent rate structure so people know what they're voting for.
That's Illinois Deputy Governor Dan Hines, former state comptroller for the state of Illinois. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin.